do you like in your sandwich? If you're going to have a sandwich, what do you have in your sandwich, anybody?
Everything.
You did say everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like all at once.
All at once, yeah, I get that. Cheese. What do you like, Thomas, in your sandwich? Oh, yes. Chocolate spread. Tuna and cucumber. Banana, okay. Get that. Bacon, brie and tomatoes. I'm coming to yours. Okay, so the first part, well, this part of Mark is known as a Mark and sandwich. Okay, this is the second half of the chapter. And that's because there are two stories, and there's an outer story, which is the story of Jairus' daughter, and that's the bread. And then in the middle, there's another story, and that's about the woman, That's about the woman who'd been unwell, who'd been bleeding for 12 years. So the same amount of time that this girl has been alive. And they're both about faith and the power of Jesus. And they just go together very well. They're put together like that for a purpose. We've got odd copies of Mark's Gospel around as well, and the odd copies are there to take if you want to have one, so you can just read through Mark's Gospel. I think there's about four left. You're very welcome to have that. But this story is one of those, if you like to really enter into a story, to have a read of, and then to shut your eyes and to imagine being a person in that story. It's a really good one, imagining the sights and the sounds and the smells and how the characters felt. We won't do that this morning, but maybe that's something you'd like to do this week. So, like brie and bacon and whatever you have in your sandwich, these two stories go together really well. And Jairus was a leader in the synagogue who almost certainly would have liked to have kept his distance from Jesus for fear of the Roman authorities, yet in fear of his daughter's life, he, well, gets rid of any political correctness and pride and dignity, and he falls at Jesus' feet in front of everybody. And Jesus and Jairus are on their way back to Jairus' house when Jesus is interrupted. And as a mum, I can just imagine how Jairus was feeling, kind of hopping up and down on his feet. You know, he didn't want that interruption. He wanted to get back there as quickly as possible. Jesus is talking with this woman. She's not anyone special. And I should think that waiting is not something that Jairus probably had to do as the leader. I should think he was waiting. He was used to other people having to wait for him. So this is new territory for him. But Jesus then stops and says, "Who touched me?" And on the face of it, it's a ridiculous question. He's in the middle of a crowd. And it's kind of inevitable. But Jesus knows that this wasn't some kind of accidental bump. And from the wording in the Greek, Jesus actually knew it was a woman as well. We don't know if he knew exactly who it was, but he did have some understanding the way that it's phrased. Jesus waits. He waits for that woman to admit that it was her. Perhaps she thought that Jesus was going to ridicule her and make an example of her. She was part of a society that looked down on women. She's not named. All the men that you read about meeting Jesus are named in the Bible, but this woman wasn't named. Neither was the 12-year-old girl. And the purity laws that were really strict at that time forbade her from even being there. Her bleeding made her unclean, and touching somebody else would make them unclean too. She was a social outcast and unable to have children, and she certainly wasn't able to worship like Jairus would have been in the synagogue. Her illness caused her a lot of physical suffering, and the original text describes it as a whipping, that intense pain. But it had far-reaching social implications too. She'd spent all her money on trying to get well, and now she approached Jesus in secret, blending in with the crowd, and believing it, she merely touched his cloak, she'd be healed. But now she'd been outed. And I love the way Michael Frost puts it. He says, she tries to steal a miracle from Jesus by touching the edge of his garment. Now, in Matthew 23, Jesus talks to the Pharisees, and he calls them hypocritical because they have their prayer shawls, and on them they've got extra long tassels. And they're doing that just to show off, basically, pretend they're more religious than other people. But people had actually come to believe that touching their shawls had some kind of mystical power in them. And perhaps this poor woman believed that touching Jesus' cloak had some kind of power in it. Jesus wasn't even a Pharisee, but she still did it. But in verse 29 we read that she was healed. She felt within her body that she was free from suffering. And instead of her uncleanliness contaminating Jesus, as she's been led to believe all her life, his power washed off and cleansed her. And now he's waiting. And now everyone's waiting. They're waiting for her to own up. Does she want to emerge from those shadows, that place that society had forced her into? She'd already been physically healed. Could she perhaps get away without not owning up, I wonder? Because everyone would see her. Would that just add to her shame and her indignity? But she takes a risk, and she does own up. And Jesus doesn't condemn her, far from it. He doesn't say, "You broke the rules. Why do you think touching my coat's going to heal you?" But as he asked her who it was and she revealed herself, he gave her honour. And he honoured her faith, even if it was perhaps a misguided faith in the healing touch of a robe. Despite being on the way to a prestigious leader, Jesus stopped. He spent time with her. He acknowledged her. He showed her respect. And he said, I don't think it said it in this clip, he said, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Your faith. Go in peace and be free from your suffering." Jesus makes her the hero of the story in front of everybody, in front of the crowd, the disciples, the synagogue leader. He removes her fear. He removes her stigma. He restores not just her physical suffering, but he also restores her social standing as well and her dignity. He calls her daughter. That's reinstating her into the Jewish society, into the family. She might not have got a name here because the writer didn't write a name, but Jesus calls her daughter. Now, this particular verse, "Your faith has healed you," has caused some misunderstanding over the years, because it wasn't faith per se that healed her. Faith is powerless to heal. Jesus healed her, but faith is the vehicle for healing. The amount of faith you have does not correlate to your physical health. I know plenty of people who are deeply spiritual, faith-filled people who are unwell. And you also don't need faith yourself to be healed. When we read the story of the paralyzed man, it was his friends who had the faith. So what's going on here? I don't think it matters how great our faith is, but it matters how great God is. Even faith the size of a mustard seed, perhaps even the misguided faith of touching a robe, opens the door for God to work. And I read yesterday in a book, I'd already written this, but by Richard Rohr, and he said, "Faith at its essential core is accepting that you are accepted. There's something in faith that's about relationship. It's not about having everything sorted. It's about trusting." When Jesus chastised the disciples in the last bit of Mark we looked at for not having faith in the storm, he was trying to encourage them to trust God. I love the way, as we go through Mark, you see how it all fits together. And however teeny-weeny our faith might be, we're meant to participate. It's that relationship thing. We're not meant to be spectators. God wants us in relationship. So if we're passive, if we have no faith, we don't even step out a little bit, There's nothing there for God to work with. There is no relationship. God can't act. So I wonder, what might there be in your life that God is you calling you to step out just a little bit of faith for? Now, back to the bit of the other bit of the bread. Right on cue, Jairus' faith is now tested. I'm not sure, perhaps he had faith at the beginning. It was more of a kind of last-ditch effort, something to help his daughter. But now his faith is tested. Does he have that seed of faith when the messengers come and tell him that his daughter has already died? Jesus literally ignores the messengers. That's the word that's used in the Greek. He ignores them and he just carries on. And he says to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe. And as I was writing this, I thought, I wonder if there are times that we very politely need to ignore people, albeit well-meaning people, but maybe people that are telling us to do something or not do something, but that's not actually God's plan for us. And are there times when we need to hear those words from Jesus? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Just believe. When Jesus arrived at the house, they laugh at him because he says, this girl's just asleep. Now, we know she wasn't just asleep. There were professional mourners there. So why did he say that? Well, I wonder if perhaps, like all his miracles, Jesus was pointing to a much larger reality, pointing to the reason that he came to bring healing and restoration to the whole cosmos. Jesus didn't heal everybody. And sleep in those days was a common metaphor for death. Not a permanent death, but like the seed in last week's podcast, that temporary state of inactivity, that dormant state, that preparation for life to come. So in saying that she was asleep, Jesus was again pointing to his resurrection. It was a sign of this revolution beginning, when he will confront death in surprising ways, just as these two healings have been surprising. And we've seen, as we've looked at Mark, Jesus' power over creation. We've seen it over cosmic forces. And this morning, over disease and over life itself. And that power comes from Jesus. It's not through him. He is the source of that power. Do we readily acknowledge that power in our lives? And I wonder if there's a situation that you need to have just a smidgen of faith for, to stretch out to God, whether that's physical, spiritual, emotional, mental healing, healing of a relationship or a situation. Or I wonder, who around you needs you to advocate for them? Like the 12-year-old girl, who do you need to bring to Jesus? Ask him for healing on their behalf. As we finish, it strikes me that these two nameless women were from very different backgrounds. The young girl, probably well known and loved, certainly part of a family with advantage and honour, with people to advocate for her. She needed healing just as much as the woman who'd been bleeding for 12 years. That poor woman, an outcast who had suffered alone with no one to fight her corner. She was just seen as an inconvenience, a problem. I wonder what rules, maybe implicit, do we have that inhibit other people from healing, finding healing and restoration in Jesus? I wonder who, if they walked through these doors, might feel crowded out, who'd struggle to have access to Jesus. Because what amazing courage and faith, what risks she took struggling through that crowd. I wonder how easy we make it for people in the church and those beyond the church to have the courage to come in. Or do they expect to be considered unclean? And my prayer is that Light of Life be marked not only by us caring deeply for people who are part of our community, but for people who are out there on the margins, those who are discriminated against, those who are considered other. We're pretty good at this, but we can always do better. I think we need to continue to nurture a truly safe environment so that everyone has the opportunity to reach out to Jesus, to meet him, to find life in all its amazing fullness. And it might mean that those of us who are not used to having to wait might have to wait a little. Our healing, our restoration requires only a small touch of faith. We will need to let go of our pride and our dignity, but Jesus will not disappoint us and he will not send us away. Let's have a moment of quiet and then Helen's going to lead us.